Don't talk to strangers. From January 1st, 1976 through March 16th, 1977, 8 children in the Detroit area were murdered. Some were assaulted in their homes, others plucked off the streets, all of them found dead. If you have not yet listened to previous episodes, please go back and start with those. We'll be waiting for you. In episode 5, we discussed the kidnapping and murder of 10-year-old Christine Mihalik. Christine disappeared on Sunday, January 2nd, 1977, from the heart of downtown Berkeley, just after visiting the local 7-Eleven store. Her body would be found 19 days later, buried in the snow on the side of a residential street in Franklin, Michigan. This week, we're leaving Oakland County, headed south across 8 Mile to the city of Detroit, where 10-year-old Valerie Bishop meets a violent end at the hand of an unidentified killer. Before we delve into Valerie's case, I want to go back to episode 1, to the murder of 16-year-old Cynthia Cadju. In February of 1977, Cynthia's murder is still unsolved, and the newly formed Child Killer Task Force is looking at her death as being the work of the Oakland County Child Killer. If we revisit Cynthia's case from January, she was picked up while walking home from a friend's house in Warren, which is in Macomb County. Cynthia was stripped naked, sexually assaulted, and her body was dumped on the side of the road, near the border of Franklin and Bloomfield Hills. Cynthia's cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. Her remains would be found by a man driving home in the small hours of January 16th. This case, this girl picked up in Warren and then raped and beaten, was folded in with the Oakland County child killings, despite her being picked up in Macomb County. What happened to her was a complete departure from the other cases, as Cynthia was a high school student, and unlike the other victims, she died of blunt force trauma to the head. And unlike the other victims, she was nude when her body was left on the side of the road. The story I'm sharing with you today, the sexual assault and murder of 10-year-old Valerie Bishop, was overlooked by the task force. On February 3, 1977, Oakland County Prosecutor L. Brooks Patterson told the press that, quote, "Detroit has a couple of homicide officers assigned to the task force. Both officers, I assume, will look closely at the matter." Whatever the task force officers saw when they looked at Valerie's case, it wasn't enough to get her included on the task force list of cases to follow up on. While Valerie's murder occurred smack in the middle of the Oakland County child killer's work, you probably haven't heard her name before. There was a flurry of coverage around her case during February of 1977, and then nothing. Nothing for years. Nothing until right now. In February of 77, Valerie Bishop is 10 years old. She's one of 6 children and a 4th grader at Carver Elementary School in Detroit. Valerie came from a big family. She had 2 older brothers, 1 younger sister, and 2 younger brothers. Their mother, Ida Bishop, she moved the family up from Alabama a few years earlier. There were jobs in Detroit, opportunity. Ida Bishop wanted her children to have options, to be successful. So they moved into the house on Aurora, near the intersection of Wyoming and Plymouth on Detroit's west side. The Bishop family lived just 10 miles south of the intersection of 12 Mile and Woodward Avenue, just 10 minutes from ground zero for the Oakland County child killer. On February 2nd, another Wednesday, 1 month to the day after the disappearance of 10-year-old Christine Mihalik, Valerie is outside playing after school. It was a warm day for February in Michigan, with temperatures in the mid-30s, and Valerie, along with her siblings, was playing outside with friends. Her mother was looking for one of the boys, one of Valerie's older brothers, to head up to the corner store, that's Houston's Party Store, and pick up a gallon of milk. When she couldn't find them, she asked Valerie to run the errand for her. Valerie was supposed to walk up with one of her friends, but she ended up going alone, a trip she'd made a dozen times before. The store's owner, Sam Houston, would later tell police that Valerie did come in and purchase milk. But Valerie didn't make it home. At first, Ida wasn't worried. Kids lose track of time. She located her older boys and told them to find their sister and bring her home. When they couldn't locate Valerie, Mrs. Bishop placed a call to the Detroit Police Department telling them that her oldest daughter was missing. Detroit police came out right away. They took her report seriously.
They called Detroit police. You know, it became apparent that something had happened because it seemed like everything started moving so fast after that. And then the police came and that right there started it all right there. It all started after the police showed up. They took it serious because she was a little girl.
That's Kimberly Bishop. She's Valerie's little sister, and we will be hearing more from her in a bit. Michigan in February. It gets dark early. 7 o'clock at night, when Detroit police took the report, it would be full dark, making it hard to do a proper search for the missing fourth grader. Police did go door to door that evening, asking if anyone had seen Valerie or seen anything suspicious. In the morning, the search resumes, and officers check out a vacant house less than a block away from the home Valerie shared with her family. It's at this vacant house that they make a grim discovery. They see blood spattered along the side of the garage. When police dig around in the snow, they find Valerie's body, still dressed for the winter weather in athletic shoes, red socks, a red dress, a winter jacket, and gloves. The milk she'd purchased at Houston's party store was beside her. The blood spatter they'd seen on the garage likely came from the impact wound on the side of Valerie's head, not from the multiple stab wounds in her abdomen. The garage that Valerie was found next to is located off of an alleyway. So, just like the four confirmed victims of the Oakland County child killer, Valerie was left on the side of the road, covered with snow, just waiting to be found. And like the other victims, Valerie was small. According to her autopsy, she was 4'8" tall and weighed just 74 pounds. That afternoon, Detroit police came to tell Ida Bishop of the news that they'd found her daughter.
She sent us all into the back room, and we all went to the back room, and, you know, when they told her, she just let out this scream that you'll never forget it.
The community rallied around the Bishop family. Friends and neighbors bringing dishes of hot food or just coming to the house to pay their respects.
I just remember it was a lot of people. It was just a lot of people coming, you know, and trying to comfort my mom. And, you know, the people in the neighborhood came and just a lot of people. And the news was there. I remember our principals from the school coming to the house. I just remember a lot of people.
These same neighbors were cooperative and helpful with the investigation, leading police to a suspect in the case, 30-year-old Moses Potter, an African-American man who lived in the neighborhood.
They identify the gentleman that lives at the corner of our street. He was a former cop.
Potter has an interesting history. At the time of Valerie's murder, he's a student at Wayne State University. He's also unemployed and recently split from his wife. Valerie's body was recovered from the back of an abandoned house on Cedar Lawn, which was almost directly behind the duplex where Moses Potter lived. Like Kimberly Bishop said, 30-year-old Moses Potter was a former Detroit police officer. In 1970, he signed up with the Detroit Police Department and went through the academy. Then he took a position with the 11th Precinct. His job with Detroit Police did not go well. Rather than hiring him at the end of his probationary period, it was recommended that his probation be extended for 6 months. Potter didn't have a good reputation and struggled to find officers that wanted to partner with him. He was also transferred from the 11th Precinct to the 10th Precinct, hoping that would improve his situation, since Potter complained that his supervisors, who were white, were pressuring him unfairly and not letting him succeed. At the end of this 6-month extension, Potter was set to be terminated, and the department advised him to seek psychiatric help. However, rather than allow himself to be fired, he skipped his scheduled probationary meeting and submitted his resignation from the department. And this happened almost 5 years to the day before Valerie's murder, on February 8, 1972. Aside from his issues with Detroit police a few years earlier, Potter is not known to law enforcement. He has no criminal record, and he was reportedly doing satisfactory work in his courses at Wayne State. On Friday, February 4th, Just a couple of days after Valerie's murder, Moses Potter is arrested and held pending a preliminary hearing later in the month. Among the items collected during his arrest are a pair of light blue pants, and the pants have visible bloodstains on them. A witness from the neighborhood told police that she saw a broad-shouldered, bald, African-American man wearing light blue pants standing in the alley watching a young girl. And while Potter is not bald, he does have a receding hairline and broad shoulders. The pants collected from his home match the description of what the man in the alley was wearing, and those pants clearly have blood on them. When the lab tests Potter's pants using the finest technology available at the start of 1977, they find that the blood is O positive, the same type as Valerie Bishop. But this is also the most common blood type, which the judge must take into consideration. Another piece of evidence brought up at the hearing is that a light brown hair is found on Valerie's clothing, and this hair was 6 inches in length. The hair did not belong to Valerie or to Moses Potter. The hair is an intriguing piece of evidence, but we don't know where on Valerie it was found. If it was on her dress or coat, it could have come from a classmate at school, a friend in the neighborhood, or even from one of her teachers. Valerie, like the other children talked about in this series, died a terrible death. Piecing things together from news reports and autopsy reports, it appears that someone struck her in the side of the head, perhaps using a board or a brick, and she was likely hit more than once. But the blow that knocked her down struck just above her left ear, crushing her skull and tearing the dura mater, the tissue that surrounds her brain. Then her killer attempted to rape her. There was no penetration, but semen is present on her body. His cruel work isn't done. Valerie is stabbed 3 times in the abdomen, and her body is hastily covered with snow. Knowing that they were taken in such a violent and cruel way is particularly painful.
It has been hard for her because she said that she suffered so long from what happened to her. I guess the last thing a mother can hear when their child is being hurt, think of that their child may think of them. As a mother, mothers comfort their children. Maybe she just felt like she wasn't there to help her. I don't know, but it just, the house was silent. It was so much sadness, so much grief.
Valerie was stabbed 3 times in the abdomen. The bright shining light of the Bishop family, Ida Bishop's oldest daughter, died alone in an alleyway on a February night covered with snow. On February 12, Lieutenant Isaiah Ike McKinnon, head of the Sex Crimes Unit for Detroit Police, does an interview with the Michigan Chronicle newspaper. If you aren't familiar with the Michigan Chronicle, it is a weekly newspaper serving the African American community in and around Detroit. McKinnon tells readers, quote, "We as adults must look out for all children, not just our own. What we're realistically talking about is taking care of one another." When asked, McKinnon says that he remembers seeing Potter around the 10th Precinct back in 1971, but he didn't know him particularly well. If McKinnon's name sounds familiar, he would go on to become the chief of police in Detroit and serve the city as deputy mayor. Now in his late 70s, McKinnon is retired but still appears at public functions. Ike McKinnon, like Valerie Bishop, was born in Alabama and came north for better opportunities. In previous episodes, we talked about how the JCs and other community organizations rallied around the families of Mark Stebbins and Christine Mihalik, but no one stepped forward to assist the Bishop family in their time of need. Valerie is buried by the county, out at Detroit Memorial Park in Warren. Her case is worked by Detroit police, led by homicide investigator Robert Hislop. With Potter in custody, it appears they have their man. Hislop told the press there were no indications that Valerie's death was related to the string of child murders happening a few miles north in Oakland County. And during the week of February 14th, Moses Potter appears before visiting Recorder's Court Judge William J. Sutherland. The evidence is presented, including eyewitness testimony from the woman who saw a broad-shouldered, bald, African-American man in the alley watching a young girl. The blood evidence is presented, blood on Potter's pants. The same type as Valerie's, but the same type as many people. The hair, the 6-inch-long light brown hair found on Valerie's clothing, is also presented, a hair that does not belong to Valerie Bishop or to Moses Potter. On Monday, the 21st of February, Sutherland found that the prosecution failed to prove their case against Potter, and he dismissed the charges without prejudice, meaning that if more evidence comes to light, Potter can again be charged in the case. Judge Sutherland tells the court that he, quote, did a lot of soul searching over the weekend, and while he is a father with young children of his own, he had to dismiss the case. A spokesman from the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office said that they planned to appeal his decision, but nothing ever came of it. Potter went on about his life, and the Bishop family continued without Valerie.
The house was silent. It was so much sadness, so much grief. It was really hard because I was the only girl left with all my brothers, you know. So, yeah, I was very lonely without her. It was time for us to grow up. After that, we knew that this was going to be a tough world. We had to prepare ourselves. My mother became so overprotective. She wouldn't let me go anywhere with my friends or anything. She was just really protective of me, and which made me rebel, of course. You know, I eventually settled down and realized that my mother was one of the strongest women I knew, so I had to be strong.
When I first learned of Valerie's case, I reached out to the records department at Detroit Police and learned that her file still exists and appears to be intact. The Wayne County Coroner's Office still has her autopsy report. This makes me hopeful that the cold case unit of the Detroit Police will take another look at her case, and I am cautiously optimistic that the biological materials collected at autopsy could still exist and finally bring answers in a long unsolved murder. There is also hope that the pants that Moses Potter was wearing, the light blue pants with bloodstains, perhaps those too are in evidence. There are arguments for and against Valerie being a victim of the Oakland County child killer. One, she disappeared on a Wednesday, just like Jill Robinson and Timothy King. Her murder occurred right in the middle of the most active time for the Oakland County child killer. The Oakland County child killer murdered Jill in December, Christine in January, and Timothy King in March. Like Mark Stebbins and Jill Robinson, Valerie Bishop suffered a head injury. The differences are far greater. All of the other victims discussed in this series were white children from the suburbs. Valerie was a black girl. She didn't live in South Oakland County, and she wasn't held for a period of days or weeks before her murder. She was sexually assaulted, where Christine Mihalik and Jill Robinson were not. Valerie was stabbed 3 times in the abdomen with a thin, short weapon. None of the confirmed victims of the Oakland County child killer were stabbed. And while I do not believe that the Oakland County child killer is responsible for the rape and murder of Valerie Bishop, I do firmly believe that her case deserves a second look. If the biological materials, including the hair found on her clothing, are still available and can be tested, I wonder what story that evidence would tell us using today's technology. Valerie's mother, Ida, and her siblings are still alive, and some of them live right here in the Detroit area. Ida Bishop didn't move away from the Aurora Street house that Valerie once called home until a couple of years ago. Her family is still waiting and still wondering what happened to their little girl. If you have information on the 1977 murder of Valerie Bishop, please contact the Detroit Police Department's Cold Case Unit.
So I want to see her case come back into the community. I want people to realize that she was somebody's daughter and sister. She was somebody's friend. She was always a good helper, always someone good to talk to. She was absolutely beautiful. She was strong. She was courageous. She was my everything. She was my hero. She was everything to me.
In last week's episode, we discussed the murder of 10-year-old Christine Mihalik, and there was a lot of talk about a hair found on her body. That hair was a mitochondrial DNA match to a man named James Vincent Gunnels. And while investigators questioned him about Christine's murder and other killings associated with this case, Gunnels insisted that he had no knowledge of the crimes. In the murder of Valerie Bishop, we have another hair, a 6-inch-long light brown hair that isn't a match to Valerie or to Moses Potter, the man arrested and later released in her case. In 2012, the Oakland County prosecutor linked hair found in a vehicle to hairs found on two male victims of the Oakland County child killer. Hair found on Mark Stebbins, as well as two hairs found on Timothy King, one hair in his underpants and another in his nasal cavity, these hairs are a mitochondrial match to hairs found in a 1966 Pontiac Bonneville owned by a man named Arch Sloan. Even more interesting is that the hairs are related to each other, but the hairs are not related to Gunnels or his brother, and to this day, law enforcement does not know who these hairs belong to. When this information was made public in 2012, the Oakland County prosecutor asked anyone who knew Sloan or borrowed his 1966 Bonneville to please contact them. 35 years after the murders, they're asking for this information. And if anyone came forward with information after that request was made, they didn't tell the public about it. So let's take a look at Arch Sloan. As you know, there is no shortage of evil men surrounding the Oakland County child murders, and Sloan is among the worst of the worst. Arch Edward Sloan was born in Pennsylvania, and he lived there until he was a teenager, when his parents relocated to the Detroit area. Sloan attended Detroit's Cooley High School, only to drop out in the 10th grade. In 1959, when Sloan was 17 years old, he is charged with gross indecency between males and serves 2 years in prison. Now, in the 50s and up through much of the 1970s, what we today would call pedophilia was often thought of as homosexual behavior. And it's possible that 17-year-old Arch Sloan was prosecuted for sexual contact with a male child. Once Sloan has served his time for the sexual assault, he relocates to Pennsylvania and lives with his grandparents. While there, Sloan works as a volunteer firefighter. And you should know that these firefighters were issued badges. If you wanted a child to listen to you, to believe you, or trust you, particularly in the 60s and 70s, being able to show them a badge was a really good place to start. By 1970, a decade after his arrest in Detroit, Sloan is still in Pennsylvania, and he's doing more than working as a volunteer fireman. He drives a school bus in Clover Hill, Pennsylvania. And I wonder how many of those children received special attention from Sloan. Like a fox guarding a henhouse, Arch Sloan is responsible for protecting children as they travel to and from school. While Sloan stayed out of trouble for several years, in late 1970, he assaults another child, and there is another charge of criminal sexual misconduct, and he is given a sentence with a minimum of 5 years, maximum of 10 years in prison. In the spring of 1975, he is incarcerated at the Western Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. The serial child molester is featured in a news piece about art and prison inmates, where Sloan talks about the joy of watercolor painting. And honestly, it's enough to make your skin crawl. Sloan is paroled in 1975, and the 34-year-old returns to his family in Michigan. And he begins a new career as a tow truck driver and gas station attendant, working out of two different service stations in Farmington Hills. This job gives him access to several different vehicles, and this also means that Sloan is out on the street in South Oakland County at the time the Oakland County child killer is active. When the task force looking into the Oakland County child killer is established, Arch Sloan's name is on tip number 3. The names of Greg Green and Christopher Bush, men we've discussed in previous episodes, they were on tips 369 and 370. And listeners, I'm really curious who was on tips 1 and 2. In 1978, Sloan is arrested and charged with criminal sexual misconduct, and he serves 6 months. If you're keeping track at home, Arch Sloan is 37 years old, and this is the third time he's been criminally charged for sexually assaulting a child. He'll be back on the street in 1979, but he won't remain free for very long because he cannot stay away from children. In the spring of 1980, Sloan is again charged with criminal sexual misconduct against a child, and he is sentenced to an entire year in prison. That's the fourth time he's been charged with sexually assaulting a child. In 1982, once he's done his time in prison, he decides to leave South Oakland County, choosing instead to live off the grid. He set up a camper on the grounds of the long-abandoned Packard plant in Detroit. Just a pedophile living among the ruins. He's still working, though, still earning a living, and still out on the street. In 1983, Sloan befriends a coworker, and this coworker has a 10-year-old son. Sloan suggests that the coworker take some time to himself, and the 10-year-old can stay with him, with Arch. Sloan even offers to take the boy fishing. Such an adventure. Arch Sloan served multiple prison terms for sexually assaulting children, and he's allowed to host a sleepover with a 10-year-old boy. I'm assuming that the coworker did not know of his criminal history. Once he's alone with the boy, Sloan tricks him into a vulnerable position and forces himself on the boy. Afterward, he takes him for a meal, then plies him with wine until he's relaxed and subdued. Then Sloan helps the child undress and gets into bed with him, where Sloan rapes him repeatedly. In the morning, he has the boy shower and dress, gives him a $5 bill, and tells him to keep quiet before returning him to his parents. In 1985, Sloan is charged for raping this boy back in 1983, two counts of first-degree criminal sexual misconduct. Finally, on his fifth trip through the justice system, Sloan receives a life sentence and enters the Michigan prison system, and that is where he remains to this day. Arch Edward Sloan is 77 years old and will live out the rest of his days warm and fed on the taxpayer's dime. Like Gunnels and Lamborghini, he insists that he has no knowledge of the child murders and has no explanation for the hairs in his vehicle matching hairs found on the bodies of Timothy King and Mark Stebbins. I have read conflicting reports about Sloan being offered a deal in return for information on the Oakland County child killer, and Sloan, like Lamborghini and Gunnels, keeps his mouth shut and does his time. In our next episode, we return to Oakland County, to the Woodward Avenue corridor, when we discuss the kidnapping and murder of 11-year-old Timothy King. I'm Nina Instead, the writer, producer, and voice behind Don't Talk to Strangers. Research assistance provided by Grace Kaleza.
Did what happened with Valerie impact how you treated your own kids?
Yes, it made me very protective. I was finding myself becoming my mother because I was so terrified of them just walking to the corner by themselves. I was terrified that the same thing that happened to her would happen to them. You know, I didn't even worry about myself. I worried so much about my kids. I guess it becomes learned behavior, because the way my mother was, I was pretty much just like her. Very protective.
The world can be a mysterious place. It can also be a boring place, so let's focus on the mysterious. Rusty Hinges is a podcast that explores mysteries, hoaxes, natural phenomena, and weird history. Basically, anything that's a bit, well, hinky. Season 1 topics include the tale of Clarence Roberts, a man who died more than once. And then there is the maybe kidnapping of June Robles, the sun that danced in the sky over Portugal, and an unsolved murder on the high seas. Rusty Hinges is generally skeptical, but never dismissive. Well, usually not dismissive. You can find Rusty Hinges on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. That's Rusty Hinges. R-U-S-T. You know what? I have faith in your spelling abilities, so go and subscribe to Rusty Hinges, and maybe you'll solve a mystery. Probably not, but you know. You never know.